Known as Tin Eye, on account of the monocle permanently screwed into his right eye, Stevens was xenophobic, rude, manipulative, ruthless, and brilliant. Spies were subjected to intense interrogation using every method to extract the truth, short of physical violence. Those deemed unsuitable as double agents were either imprisoned or tried and executed. The others, a small minority, were offered a choice. Work for Britain against Germany or face the hangman's noose. You have forfeited your life, but there is a way of saving your life, was how Tin Eye framed the issue. Unsurprisingly, this argument proved persuasive. Of the 25 German spies sent to Britain between September 3rd and November 12th, 1940, all but one was caught. The lone evader shot himself. 5 were executed, 15 were imprisoned, and 4 became double agents, the first recruits of what would grow into a substantial army of deceivers. The officer in command of this fledgling force was Thomas Argyle Robertson, known as Tommy, but more usually as Tar, on account of his initials. Spymasters are expected to be intense types, ferociously clever and faintly sinister. On the surface, Tar Robertson appeared to be none of these. The son of a Scottish banker, he was cheery, amiable, funny, and self-mocking. If he ever opened a book, there is no record of it. As a young man, he had, according to one relative, an almost suicidal appetite for dusk-to-dawn partying, pretty women, and fast cars. Expensive tastes that put paid to his army career in the Seaforth Highlanders when he ran out of funds. After an undistinguished stint in the city, in 1933 he was recruited into MI5 through the Old Boy Network. He retained a military air and the tartan army trousers that earned him the nickname Passion Pants. In demeanour, he was a perfect officer type who could have been played by Ronald Colman, the English actor, with friendly eyes and an assertive way about him. His family considered him less than promising. But once installed in MI5, Tar revealed a natural talent for hanging around in pubs and picking up gossip. He was immensely personable and monstrously good-looking, according to one colleague, with a charm that could melt an iceberg, and an unmistakable twinkle that encouraged the spilling of confidences. Beneath the affability and delightful chuckle was a personality of granite determination and a ruthless streak. Hugh Trevor Roper considered his Secret Service colleagues, by and large, pretty stupid, some of them very stupid. But Tar he regarded as a real genius, with an uncanny knack for reading character and knowing instinctively when he was being misled. Robertson knew better than anyone else in British intelligence how to spot a lie, and therefore how to tell one. The British Secret Services traditionally took a fastidious approach to double agents, regarding the practice of turning intercepted spies and using them to mislead the enemy as faintly disreputable. Such creatures were classed as agents doubles in French, as if to underline that this was typically duplicitous continental behaviour. But before the war, MI5 recruited only one truly important double agent, an experiment that almost ended in disaster. Arthur Owens was a Welsh-born electrical engineer with a shifty look, who began his spying career by providing information to MI6 after his visit to German shipyards. Owens also made contact with the Abwehr, which gave him the task of recruiting radical Welsh nationalists for sabotage operations. This was an early hint of the Abwehr's bizarre but firmly held belief that the Welsh valleys were filled with violent secessionists awaiting the opportunity, with Nazi encouragement, to rise up against their English oppressors. He then turned double agent and agreed to work against the Germans. Tar was made case officer to Owens, codenamed Snow, a partial anagram of his surname, and eventually concluded that this stupid little man, given to doing silly things at odd times, was playing each side against the other, but inefficiently. The case was eventually wound up, largely because Owens was a fantasist whose mind did not work on logical lines. Yet the Snow case had helped Bletchley Park to break the Abwehr code, provided useful leads on tracking down other German spies, and saved us from absolute darkness on the subject of German espionage, according to Dick White, Liddell's deputy. It also gave Robertson an early taste of just how fickle, troublesome, and valuable a double agent could be. It was Tarr who had pointed out that simply capturing, executing, or interning enemy spies, however satisfying as an act of war, offered no long-term benefit. There was nothing tender-hearted in Tarr's desire to preserve German spies from the gallows. This was hard-eyed calculation. The questions asked of spies by their German spymasters offered useful clues to what the Abwehr did not know. If the Germans believed they had a functioning network of spies in Britain, they might feel it unnecessary to send more. If the Abwehr thought its spies were alive, at liberty, and functioning well, it would open up possibilities for dialogue and deception. A live spy was more useful than a dead one, though a lot more trouble. Section B1A was launched, a new subsection of Liddell's B section, with Tarr Robertson at the helm. The first spies selected as double agents proved to be duds. Georges Graf, codenamed, punningly, Giraffe, was a Czechoslovak citizen who had served in the French army before being dispatched to Britain by the Abwehr. Popov had been given his name by von Kastorf, so the Germans obviously trusted him, and Popov's willingness to pass his name on to the British, unaware that Graf had already been turned, was proof that he was playing straight. Kurt Gusser, codenamed Gander, naturally, landed by parachute in October, with only a transmitting wireless. Unable to receive messages from his handlers, he was of limited use, and the Gander case was swiftly wound up, as was Giraffe. Of greater interest were two Scandinavians who had trained together in the Hamburg Abwehr station. Goethe Karoli, a Swedish journalist who had lost a fortune in an Uppsala silver fox farm, and Wolf Schmidt, a Danish fascist. Karoli parachuted into the Northamptonshire countryside on the night of September 6, 1940, landed badly, and staggered into a ditch to try to sleep off his concussion. A farmhand spotted his feet sticking out of a hedge. He was carrying a radio transmitter, £200, and a loaded pistol. Schmidt landed 2 weeks later, sprained an ankle, limped into the Cambridgeshire village of Willingham, in a natty blue suit, but with an unmistakable foreign accent, and was promptly arrested. Though a fanatical Nazi, in the view of Tin Eye Stevens, Karoli agreed to work as a double agent if Schmidt's life was spared. With cruel but effective psychological manipulation, Schmidt was told that his friend had betrayed him. Enraged, he spilled the beans and agreed to change sides. Karoli was given the codename Summer, but the Swede seems to have had second thoughts. One evening, in his safe house in Hinxton, near Cambridge, Karoli crept up behind his minder while he was playing solitaire and tried to throttle him with a piece of rope. When this failed, he apologized, tied the man to a chair, and ran off with a can of sardines, a pineapple, and a large canvas canoe. He then stole a motorcycle and motored, very slowly, toward the coast with the canoe balanced on his head. He intended to paddle to Holland. A roadman reported to police that a man with a canoe had fallen off his motorcycle on Pampisford Road, and he had helped the man throw the canoe over a hedge. Karoli was arrested outside Ely. Clearly unreliable, the Swede was declared unfit for double agent work and imprisoned for the rest of the war. After initial resistance, Schmidt proved much more cooperative and was given the codename Tate, because Robertson thought he looked like the music hall comedian Harry Tate. He would prove to be the longest-serving double agent of them all. The handling of double agents, Tarr concluded, was going to require considerable subtlety. The double agent is a tricky customer and needs the most careful supervision. His every mood has to be watched. These erratic characters showed an alarming propensity to swap sides. If any of them managed to break away and make contact with the Germans, Robertson reflected, this could blow our whole show. If the Germans invaded and there was a danger the double agents might fall into enemy hands, they will be liquidated forcibly. Robertson was becoming fond of his brood of double agents, but he would not hesitate to kill them if he had to. This, then, was the newly formed club into which Dusko Popov was welcomed by a smiling Tarr Robertson in the lobby of the Savoy Hotel. The new double agent had already been given the codename Scoot, a play on his name carrying the hint that Popoff might pop off or scoot at any moment. Under wartime rules, a spy's codename, or nom de guerre, should contain no hint of his or her identity. Robertson joyously and consistently ignored this directive and established his own rule. Every spy name must contain a joke, a pun, a hint, or a nudge. Tarr had already learned enough about his new recruit's mode of life to know that a cell at Camp 020 and a grilling from Tin Eye Stevens were neither necessary nor advisable. Instead, Popoff was lodged in a comfortable room at the Savoy, where Robertson and his colleagues interrogated him on his story, his recruitment by Johnny Yibsen, the meeting with Mertzinger, his encounter with the suave, hairy-handed von Karsthoff in Lisbon, his questionnaire, and his instructions for making secret ink. Popoff struck his interrogators as open and honest, and his story was corroborated by information from most secret sources. He made no monetary demands and seemed to want to work as a double agent for the British out of a combination of anti-Nazi conviction and a thirst for adventure. Tarr was impressed. "I have a strong feeling we are on to something good." As a businessman from a neutral country, Popoff could travel freely between London and Lisbon and maintain direct personal contact with his German handler. The German seemed absolutely obsessed with the idea that he has a wide circle of friends and business connections in England, even though he knew virtually nobody in the country. It will be necessary to supply him with the names of a number of supposed friends. After 4 days in his company, Tarr was convinced that the young Serb, with the carefree attitude, was playing straight and prepared to risk his life. "Scoot left an exceedingly favourable first impression upon all of us. His manner was absolutely frank, and we all considered without question that he was telling the truth. A token of appreciation was in order, and Tarr knew exactly what sort of reward Scoot would enjoy. On Christmas Eve 1940, MI5 laid on the most extravagant party that bomb-battered London could provide. Courtney Young, a young officer in B section, was appointed Popoff's carousing partner. They began by consuming a substantial lunch with Robertson at Quaglino's restaurant. The remainder of the afternoon was spent playing billiards at the Lansdowne Club with plenty of beer. In the early evening, they drank sherry at the University's Club before heading back to the Savoy for dinner. Young then suggested that they go dancing at the Suivi Club, where they met two attractive young women who danced with them all night. These, too, had been furnished by MI5. "Scoot was obviously pleased by the interest shown by the two girls," reported Young, who had some difficulty keeping up with the pace of Popoff's revelry. "He enjoyed himself thoroughly and took part in the usual Christmas Bonhamus rioting, well lubricated with champagne." In the early hours, Popoff and his minder staggered back to the Savoy, both viewing things through slightly rose-tinted spectacles. To retain German confidence, Agent Scoot would need to feed his handlers some true but harmless information, known in spy jargon as chicken feed, filling and substantial, but lacking in real nourishment. He would also need a convincing cover story. For this, Tarr turned to Ewan Montague, an officer in naval intelligence who would later devise Operation Mincemeat. Montague was rich, well-connected, and a keen yachtsman, just the sort of person that the Germans would expect Dushko Popoff to befriend. They met in the bar of the Savoy, where Montague handed over a batch of true, low-level information on naval matters that could be passed to the Germans without danger, and some minor untruths, including the suggestion that British merchant convoys would be accompanied by at least one submarine in the future. In a small way, that might give the U-boat Wolfpack's pause for thought. Before they parted, Montague handed Popoff a handwritten note to show to the Germans as proof that he had indeed met this friendly and indiscreet naval officer. "I much enjoyed meeting you," wrote Montague. "It is so nice at these troubled times to meet another who is as mad as I am about sailing." In response to the question of which British figures were opposed to Churchill, he was told to cite Lords Brockett, Lymington, and Londonderry as definitely members of the party that would be prepared to accept peace terms with Germany. The three peers were widely suspected of pro-German sympathies, and there could be no harm in confirming what the Germans must already know. Montague was captivated by Popoff. "I found him a most charming person. and would be most surprised if he is not playing straight with us," he told Tar. "I hope that his having met me and having laid the foundation for further information will satisfy his employers. I should have thought it ought to be enough to show for a first visit to this country." January 2, 1941 saw the formation of the 20, or Double X, Committee to oversee the Double Cross system, the first and only government body named with a Roman numerical pun. The committee was formed to coordinate the work of double agents and supply these agents with a stream of chicken feed to build up the credibility of the spies. John Masterman, an Oxford history don, part-time detective novelist and sportsman, was appointed chairman of the 20 committee, which included directors of intelligence for the Army, Navy and RAF, and representatives of MI5, MI6, Home Forces and Home Defence. While Robertson and the case officers of B1A would be responsible for the day-to-day running of the double agents, the 20 committee would manage overall strategy and cook up a diet of harmless truths, half-truths, and uncheckable untruths to feed to the enemy. The committee met at MI5 headquarters in 58 St. James's Street every Thursday afternoon for the rest of the war. Giraffe's case died chiefly through lack of nourishment, in Masterman's opinion. No double agent would ever go hungry again. The 20 committee was referred to by its members as the club, and Masterman organized it with a particular sort of club in mind, a cricket club. "Running a team of double agents is very like running a club cricket side," he wrote, and as a first-class cricketer himself, he approached the task exactly as if he were assembling a thoroughly well-trained and trustworthy team of cricketers. Masterman was a cold fish, apparently without romantic feelings for either sex. But cricket was different. "Cricket was my first and most enduring passion," he wrote. He thought of espionage in terms of stumpings, no balls, innings and overrates, and of spies as players, some of whom required a good deal of net practice before they were really fit to play in a match. The relationship between cricket, that most English of sports, and spying, at which the British have always excelled, is deep-rooted and unique. Something about the game attracts the sort of mind also drawn to the secret worlds of intelligence and counterintelligence, a complex test of brain and brawn, a game of honour interwoven with trickery, played with ruthless good manners and dependent on minute gradations of physics and psychology, with tea breaks. Some of the most notable British spies have been cricketers or cricket enthusiasts. Hitler played cricket, but only once. In 1930, it was claimed that, having seen British POWs playing in southern Germany during the First World War, the Nazi Party leader asked to be initiated into the mysteries of our national game. A match was played against Hitler's team, after which he declared that the rules should be altered by the withdrawal of the use of pads and using a bigger and harder ball. Hitler could not understand the subtlety of a game like cricket. He thought only in terms of speed, spectacle, violence. Cricket was the ideal sport on which to model an organization bent on stumping the Führer. Tar Robertson was no mean cricketer himself, a left-arm spinner whose specialty was a cunningly spun, deceptively slow ball. As Tar assembled his team, Masterman was already imagining a time when they would be ready to take the field for what might be a decisive match against German intelligence. The prime difficulty was that we never knew the date when this decisive match would take place. It would be many months before the Double Cross players were ready to compete, but Masterman knew that in Dushko Popov, he had already found a singularly talented opening batsman. On the day the 20 committee was born, Tar took his new protégé to lunch and rehearsed, in detail, the story he was to tell the Germans. 24 hours later, Scoot was on a plane back to Lisbon. "We have in him a new agent of high quality," Tar reported, confident that the sheer force of Popov's personality would protect him. If Tar was right, then Agent Scoot might help win the war. If not, then Dushko Popov was already as good as dead. 3. Roman and the Cat. Roman Czernawski, the diminutive Polish spy, parachuted back into occupied France at dawn on November 8, 1941. He landed in a melon field, in the rain, not far from Tours. As he headed back to Paris on an overcrowded bus, wearing a beret and raincoat, he reflected, "I wonder if anybody here could imagine that I had my dinner in England." Safely back among his family of spies, Chernovsky announced that a celebration was in order. The 16th of November would mark the first anniversary of the Inter Alia network, and there was much to be proud of. Some 50 agents, each with two or three sub-agents, had so far produced no less than 97 reports, furnishing the British with a complete picture of the German order of battle. The leaders of the network assembled at the Montmartre flat. Roman Chernovsky, Mathilde Carré, René Borny, and Maurice Wlodarczyk, a former Polish naval radio operator who worked the transmitter. They ate sandwiches and sipped the black market champagne Chernovsky had managed to scrounge. At 8 p.m., they gathered around the wireless to listen to the BBC. Each section head of the Inter Alia had instructions to tune in. At 8:15, the BBC announcer played a snatch of patriotic French music and then intoned, "Many happy returns to our family in France on the occasion of their anniversary." They clinked glasses. Maurice sent a wireless message to London. "Against the Germans, always and in every way. Vive la liberté." The team drifted away. Chernovsky, a little tipsy, reflected that their underground work was taking its toll. Mathilde, in particular, was overworked and was obviously tired. As co-founder of the network, she seemed irked that Chernovsky had received a medal, the Virtuti Militari, while her work was barely acknowledged. The next night, Chernovsky and René Barny dined in their favorite restaurant. He asked the band to play Gloomy Sunday, also known as the Hungarian Suicide Song, a hit that year for Billie Holiday. "Why did you ask for that?" asked René. "It's so sad." In the rainy street, as they were walking home, Chernovsky noticed a man in a raincoat, his face obscured by an umbrella. He tried to place the half-remembered face. "I must be tired," he thought. Chernovsky was in deep sleep when a gunshot went off and the Gestapo burst into his bedroom. René screamed. The light was switched on, and in front of me I saw the man in the Macintosh and beret with a revolver in his hand. Now he recognized him. Hugo Bleicher, the most feared German counterintelligence officer in Paris. It was an intelligent face, Roman reflected, with eyes that were sharp but not violent. He was bundled into a waiting car and driven directly to the Hotel Edward VII, headquarters of the secret military police. If only someone could warn Mathilde, Roman thought. When Mathilde Carré got home from her early morning walk, she saw, without immediately comprehending, that her door was splintered, hanging off its hinges. At the same moment, a burly Gestapo officer appeared at her elbow. She felt oddly calm as he led her away. "It was a great gamble, and today I have lost. But I'm a good gambler," Mathilde reflected. The Inter Alia network, so painstakingly assembled, had been torn apart in days, destroyed from within because of an ordinary denunciation dictated by personal spite. Hugo Keifer, a former airman with a reputation as a wide boy, or chancer, had been responsible for smuggling messages into France from Britain on the Normandy fishing boats. One of his own informants had ratted on him, a certain Madame Dombier, because, it was said, he had refused to sleep with her. Under torture, Keifer had revealed the name of his contact in the network, a Pole named Krutke, who in turn had directed the Gestapo to the flat in Montmartre. When Bleicher burst into Roman Chernovsky's bedroom, he did not even know the name of the man he was arresting. Mathilde Carré was also brought to the Hotel Edward VII and cracked at once. "I was like an animal caught in the headlights," she recalled. Hugo Bleicher offered her a deal. Other senior members of the network had already confessed, he lied, and implicated her. "You have committed enough crimes to be shot several times over." He offered her the choice between collaboration and death, warning, "If you double-cross me, you will be shot immediately without trial." He pushed a cup of ersatz coffee toward her across the desk. If she cooperated, he would pay her 6,000 francs a month. "Great Britain makes other people work hard for her, and doesn't even pay them decently," he added sourly. In the First World War, Bleicher had been sent on an espionage mission across the lines, dressed in British uniform, and had been captured. A prisoner for 2 years, he claimed he had been treated inhumanely by his British captors, not only with handcuffs on his wrists, but manacles on his ankles. Bleicher loathed Britain. It took Mathilde just 10 minutes to accept Hugo Bleicher as her new master. She would look back on this decision as the greatest act of cowardice of my life. Yet it had been a purely animal reaction, prompted by survival instinct. Winning Bleicher's confidence seemed the surest means of one day being able to escape. That morning, Mathilde had a prearranged meeting with an agent at the Pam Pam restaurant. Bleicher told her to keep the rendezvous. "You must behave normally. Your life and liberty depend on it." The agent was arrested as he entered the café. Afterward, Bleicher took Mathilde to lunch. "You see how easy it is?" he said. Unable to eat, she caught sight of herself in the mirror, with a strangely haunted look in my eyes. She began passing names to Bleicher, and one by one, all her former comrades were picked up and interrogated. Madame Gaby at La Palette, Maurice, the radio operator, Rapide, the courier. Some broke down and implicated others. "A few men proved their mettle, but in comparison women showed better spirit," Tsiarnavsky later wrote. A week after the first arrests, more than 60 inter alia agents and sub-agents had been rounded up. Mathilde revealed every aspect of the network she had helped to build, enough evidence to ensure Roman Tsiarnavsky's death many times over. Bleicher was delighted. Another man might simply have smashed the network and killed everyone in it, but Bleicher was cleverer than that. Ostensibly for her own safety, Mathilde was moved into Bleicher's home, a large mansion in the elegant Paris suburb of Saint-Germain-en-Laye. "We have decided to continue the messages from Inter Alliés," Bleicher told her. "We're going to play some fine tricks on the British. We shall inform them that Armand, Roman Tsiarnavsky, and Violette, René Bonny, have been arrested. But you are going to stress in a message to London that you managed to save the third wireless set and that you will continue with your principal agents. No one in the network knows you are in our hands." This was the German version of Double Cross. Mathilde claimed that Bleicher treated her with perfect courtesy during these weeks. Refined and teetotalist, in the evenings he would play the piano for her. Soon they became lovers. Later, in overwrought prose, Mathilde struggled to explain why. "I had felt the icy breath of death, and suddenly found warmth once more in a pair of arms. I hated myself for my weakness, and as a result of my abasement, I hated the Germans even more." At the Hotel Edward VII, Roman Tsiarnavsky was subjected to an exhausting interrogation, but no violence. He told Hugo Bleicher nothing. What annoyed him most was the small, fat Gestapo officer who rubbed his hands with glee as Roman was marched in and started to laugh contentedly. The Pole had expected to be tortured and then killed. Instead, he was transferred to Fresnes prison, south of Paris, and left in a dank cell. Tsiarnavsky had been in prison for 6 weeks, and was rather surprised to still be alive, when he learned of Mathilde Carré's treachery. He had been treated severely but without brutality, questioned repeatedly, denied exercise, and fed scraps, yet no one had laid a finger on him. German and Vichy newspapers predicting imminent Nazi victory were left in his cell. Bleicher appeared from time to time, but instead of issuing threats, he was full of flattery, remarking that he was most impressed by the Inter Alliés organization and the completeness of the records which they found at his HQ. Roman did not know what to make of this red-faced man with the thick glasses who, though intelligent and quick-witted, was always boasting. He was nettled to see the German was wearing his pullover, stolen from his flat, but he conceded that there was something impressive about the Abwehr counter-espionage officer. "He is a man of great ability and ingenuity, and a specialist in running double agents," he noted with hindsight. "Also a man of great personal ambition." One morning, René Bonny appeared in Roman Tsiarnavsky's cell, ushered in by a warder. The last Roman remembered of his lover was her terrified eyes, as she was frog-marched away from the Montmartre flat. René quickly explained what her jailers had told her, that Mathilde had given everything away. The Interallier network was destroyed. Even so, the Germans felt an extraordinary admiration for our methods, she said, suggesting that Roman might exploit this favourable circumstance. René was certainly a plant, whether willing or otherwise, sent to weaken his resolve. Roman's first response was to try to make sense of Mathilde's betrayal. It is possible she acted under German blackmail, he reasoned. When working in this terrain, one cannot apply any rules concerning the trust one may place in individuals. The only value is a man's character and his resistance in moments of crisis and his loyalty to ideals. Many years later, he was still pondering her behavior and his own. Roman's morale improved after René's visit. He had been contemplating suicide, fearing interrogations by force, but now Tchernavsky was once again plot-hatching, his favorite activity. As one of his spy masters observed, a firing squad did not fit in with his grandiose and dramatic idea of his own destiny. René's visit had suggested a way out of this predicament, which was, of course, precisely what Bleicher had intended. On November 29th, Roman Tchernavsky handed his jailers a letter addressed to General Otto von Stulpnagel, Germany's military commander in France. For sheer gall, it was remarkable even by Tchernavsky's standard. No collaboration which might be proposed to me could come about unless I was convinced that I was working for the good of the Polish nation, he told Stulpnagel. If the German nation has amongst its plans the reconstruction of the rights of the Polish nation, in this case alone discussions about my collaboration could take place. Any such discussion must take place with an officer of the General Staff who knows these problems and is authorized to discuss them with me. No one had actually asked Tchernavsky to collaborate. He was making an offer, but in such a way that it sounded as if he were accepting one. The next day, a man in the uniform of a colonel entered the cell and saluted. Tchernavsky bowed. The fellow was middle-aged and lantern-jawed, with thick grey hair and an intelligent look. He introduced himself as Oskar Reiler, chief of counterintelligence for the Paris Abwehr Station. Roman noted his manicured fingernails. This man was a negotiator, a fixer, not a fighter. Without preamble, Reiler launched into a lecture on Nazi history. The National Socialists were the new Romans, he explained. The Führer did not wish to oppress Poland and asked only for Polish support to counter the Bolshevik threat from the East. We do not deny the rights of the Polish nation, but we ask its cooperation. In defying Germany, Poles like Tchernavsky were opposing the tide of history. You have tied yourself on one hand with capitalist Jewish England and, on the other, with communist Bolshevik Russia, the colonel continued. By joining us, you will contribute to our program to advance Europe by several centuries in one leap. General Sikorsky, he said, was backing the wrong horse. Whatever collaboration Poland might have with Great Britain would be merely to help the selfish aims of Great Britain. All things considered, the best solution would be to come under the cultural protection of Germany, since German culture is preferable to barbarian culture. It was an extraordinary performance, revealing an excellent knowledge of Polish history, and perfectly pitched to appeal to a patriotic anti-communist Pole weakened by hunger, but fattened up on a diet of Nazi propaganda and fearful that his country might fall under Soviet rule. Above all, it played on Roman Tchernavsky's abundant vanity, suggesting that he alone could raise the Polish nation on the side of Germany. Thus began what Tchernavsky described as the War of Nerves. He would later claim that he had merely played a part, pretending to discuss collaboration as though I had really swallowed their propaganda, when it is unlikely he ever had any such intention. He was determined, however, to keep fighting for Poland, and in order to do that, he needed to get out of prison. As the German officer rose to leave, Tchernavsky dropped an unsubtle hint. In my opinion, England is leading us, Poles, up the garden path. When Oskar Reiler returned a few days later, he was in civilian clothes. The propaganda lecture continued. The Germans were at the doors of Moscow. The war against England would certainly be won. If Roman Chernovsky sided with Germany and persuaded his compatriots to do likewise, he would be working for the good of the Polish nation. The Pole responded hotly that he would never under any circumstances work against my countrymen. Colonel Ryla smiled broadly. Chernovsky composed another letter. The future of Poland lies in German hands. The British will do nothing for us and deliver us to the Russian barbarism, he wrote. I am prepared to discuss placing myself at the disposal of Germany while at the same time being of use to my own country, Poland. If the Germans could smuggle him into Britain, he said, he would spy for Germany. Once in place, he could gather information on British aircraft and tank production, troop deployments, and, above all, preparations for and the possibilities of a second front. In short, he would do for Germany what he had been doing in France against them. He promised great things. I will group around me persons dissatisfied with the British alliance and thus create a powerful fifth column, ready to rise up the moment that Germany attacks England. He made just two demands, that the agents of Inter Alliés captured with him were not to be put to death and were to be set free at the conclusion of the war, and that Germany would, after winning the war, assist his country and people in a manner commensurate with the valuable work he would no doubt have achieved. Much of this was posturing nonsense, but some was undoubtedly genuine. With his reignited self-confidence, Chernovsky truly believed that he could negotiate on behalf of Poland and change the course of the war. It was, Ryla admitted, an extremely odd situation. A captured spy was laying down conditions. The effect of the letter was instantaneous. Two new German officers appeared in his cell and, in unusually polite and friendly terms, expressed their pleasure at the fact that, after all, I had come to realize the good brought by National Socialism to the new Europe. If Roman Chernovsky could deliver all he promised, then he would find Germany highly appreciative. But how, they asked, could they be sure he would not betray them? The Pole's response was indignant. I told them I could carry out my mission successfully only on condition that I enjoyed their absolute trust. But Ryla knew better than to rely on the word of a man who had already amply demonstrated his talent for subterfuge. Chernovsky's mother was in occupied Poland, he pointed out. His brother was in a German POW camp. His lover sat in a nearby cell, and dozens of members of his network had been rounded up. Your companions are in prison, Ryla remarked pointedly. You know yourself what the sentence will be if the courts have to impose a punishment for spying in wartime. Chernovsky responded hotly, If I work for you, it will be for ideological reasons. There will be no need for reprisals. But the German did not need to spell out the threat. If he should double-cross them, his friends, colleagues, and family would be killed. The Pole had long considered himself as a prime candidate for martyrdom, but more than his own life was now at stake. Should I fail, the fury of the Germans would know no bounds, he reflected. I knew that the fate of my former colleagues was practically a foregone conclusion, but now I was involving my mother and my brother. This time I had no right to commit any mistakes. On the afternoon of July 14th, 1942, two Gestapo non-commissioned officers entered Chernovsky's cell and ordered him to put on his shoes. One was small and pudgy. The other looked tough and cunning, like an intelligent boxer. Chernovsky wondered for a moment if he was about to be killed. He was led out of the prison gates and driven to a flat on the Rue du Freneuil, where Colonel Oskar Ryla was waiting. Ryla handed over a set of civilian clothes, false papers taken from him at the time of his arrest, 10,000 francs in ration coupons, and some money to enable him to go to the barber and have a shave. Ryla laid out his instructions. Chernovsky should make his way to unoccupied France, re-establish contact with the Polish underground, and get himself smuggled to Britain. Bleicher would shadow him in the Vichy zone in case of difficulties. Chernovsky should tell Polish intelligence that he had given the Germans the slip while being transferred between prisons. The prisons would be notified that I had escaped en route to the car. His new German codename would be Hubert. Canaris himself had approved the plan to woo Chernovsky, play on his patriotism, recruit him, and then send him to Britain. But Ryla was fully aware of the dangers. The English knew that Armand had fallen into our hands, he later wrote. Our English opposite numbers would quite obviously assume that he had been released from prison by us and sent over with secret orders. There was the risk that the enemy intelligence service would then attempt to transmit misleading information to us. But Ryla was confident that if Chernavsky began feeding him falsehoods, he would spot the deception and be able to pick up important clues as to the real intentions of the British by reading Roman's messages in reverse. If the enemy attempted to mislead us, we could, under certain circumstances, gather important information. Chernavsky could hardly believe his fantastic luck. He went to a barber on the Rue Pigalle to have his prison beard removed, and then ate in a Russian restaurant. Walking back to the flat, he stopped from time to time to check if he was being tailed. No one seemed to be following him. He was free, after a fashion. 4. Coat trailing. Elvira de la Fuente Chaudoir, boredom-prone, good-time girl and aspiring spy, was perched at the roulette table in a Cannes casino when she was approached by a Frenchman named Henri Chauvel, a wealthy Nazi collaborator, who asked her out to dinner. She had no hesitation in accepting. Elvira had spent several weeks coat-trailing through the south of France, spending time in casinos and expensive restaurants, while maintaining her cosmopolitan cover as a society girl mixing in the very top circles, without so much as a sniff from German intelligence. Cannes was an oasis of self-indulgence. In her diary, Elvira described the small class of unscrupulous millionaires living it up in southern France while war raged. People who get all the food they want, who wear lovely clothes, and who, though dancing is forbidden even to them, spend their nights gambling in the casinos. There was nothing she liked better than dancing and gambling, but having spent the funds provided by MI6, she was almost broke again. Her existence was altogether more agreeable than enduring the Blitz in London. But Elvira was beginning to feel guilty. I felt I was doing little to justify Danzy's investment in me. She needed someone to pick up her coat. Henri Chauvel seemed like a good start. Of the millionaires enjoying life in the south of France in the spring of 1941, few were more unscrupulous than Chauvel, a property owner and entrepreneur who had discovered that currying favor with the Germans was a most effective way of making money. He took Elvira to dinner at the Carlton Hotel, which he owned, and ordered champagne. Chauvel was obviously rolling in money. At the bar, a group of men were getting noisily drunk. One stood out from the others, very tall, with pitch-black hair. He spoke French, but even from a distance Elvira could hear his strong German accent. The German seemed very interested in me and looked at me all the time, she wrote. He was young and good-looking. She asked Chauvel if he knew him. I'll introduce you to him, but in the end he's just a pig like the others, said the Frenchman, piqued at Elvira's interest in another man. She pressed him for a name. Chauvel shrugged. He is a secret agent of Goering's and changes his name every day. A few days later, Elvira was at the bar of the Miramar Hotel, drinking a whiskey, when the German appeared at her shoulder, bowed, and introduced himself as Bibi. His real name was Helmut Bleil. He had arrived in unoccupied France in 1940 as part of the commission enforcing the terms of the Franco-German armistice, but his role as an economic expert was a cover. Like Johnny Jebsen, he was a freelance spy. But unlike Jebsen, he had no formal role in the Abwehr, having been recruited personally by Goering. Bibi bought Elvira another drink, and then invited her to dinner at one of the most expensive black market restaurants. He seemed an odd but intriguing fellow. His hands shook and he drank heavily, but he had the most graceful walk and was obviously a gentleman. He appeared deeply anxious. Elvira wondered if he might have an inferiority complex. Later he confessed that he feared he might be spotted as a German and shot in the street by the resistance. At first, Bibi seemed to want to keep the conversation to ordinary things. When she asked him what he did, he laughed and said he was supposed to be attached to the Madrid embassy as an economic specialist. He didn't elaborate. Elvira explained that she was separated from her husband and visiting her parents in Vichy. Casually, she remarked that she had run out of money and would soon be returning to England. After dinner, he said he would like to take her to the casino. Despite his peculiar combination of swagger and paranoia, Elvira found him a pleasant fellow. Elvira and Bibi met again the next evening, and the next. One moment he was full of laughter and enjoyed everything like a child. The next, he would be saturated in alcoholic gloom, telling her the war was very silly and such a pity, and the Russians were awful, and it would have been much more sensible for England and Germany to unite against Russia. "Why are you going back to England?" he asked. "You could have a much better time in Paris, and London is going to be bombed worse than ever." Finally, Bibi made his move, but tentatively. Apropos of nothing at all, he observed that his Portuguese banker had told him there were packets of money to be made in England at the moment. There was a pause. "We might do some little business together." Elvira sensed that here at last was an opportunity to start justifying my SIS salary. I pricked up my ears. "How much does a woman like you need to live really well in London?" asked the German. Elvira told him she would be quite happy with anything over 100 a month. "That is very little," said Bibi, looking relieved, "and very easy to make." "How?" asked Elvira. They sat talking on the deserted Cannes seafront until 3 in the morning. Bibi explained that he had friends who would pay generously for political, financial, and industrial information about Britain. "After the war, everyone will be very poor, so it is up to each one of us to try to make some money now. After all, that is the only thing that counts." He was rather vague about exactly how she should obtain this information. As Bleyl stared out over the dark Mediterranean, he said soberly, "You will have to be terribly careful and never tell a soul about it, because if you do, you will be the first to pay." The words hovered somewhere between a warning and a threat. Within 48 hours, Bibi reported that his friends had agreed to pay her £100 a month, to start with, and extra sums for good information. The money would be paid through Swiss and Portuguese accounts, disguised as alimony payments from her ex-husband. Her code name would be Dorette. She would communicate using secret ink, he said, a marvelous trick by which she could write to them without ever being discovered. Letters should be sent either to Chauvel at the Hôtel de Paris in Monte Carlo, or to a cover address in Lisbon. "We just want facts, not opinions or reactions." Elvira interrupted him. "This is already quite different to the little business we were originally meant to do together. This is infinitely more interesting, and if you are successful, it represents a life job." 10 days later, an excited Bleyl, already quite drunk, met Elvira in a Cannes park shortly before noon. He looked around nervously and asked me if I was sure I wasn't being followed. Then he reached into his pocket and handed her a small bottle of colourless liquid. "The Germans are the greatest chemists in the world, and this is their newest and best invention." Elvira did not say that she already had a bottle of British secret ink in her handbag. They repaired to the empty lounge of the Hotel Majestic, where Bleyl ordered champagne. "I always act on intuition," Bleyl said, "and I feel I can just trust you. If I am wrong, it will ruin my whole career." Elvira felt a stab of remorse. Bibi might be a sozzled Nazi spy, but in character he was a child and seemed hopelessly out of his depth. "I felt rather sorry for him, and frankly almost wished I had kept out of all this, but bucked myself up by thinking that since you start doing a job, you must do it fully and shut all softness away." Bleyl's hands were trembling. He reached for his hip flask. "You must never breathe a word of this to any living soul," he said, and swigged. Elvira merely remarked, "I have no desire to spend the rest of the war in prison." Lily Sergeyev was being driven mad by the waiting. She had volunteered to spy for Germany, but Germany was in no hurry whatsoever to take up the offer. Even her terrier poodle, Babs, seemed to be feeling the strain. For almost a year, she had kicked her heels in Paris, while Major Emil Kliman, nominally her Abwehr case officer, arranged meetings that he failed to turn up for on time. When he did appear, he enthusiastically discussed the missions Lily might perform for the Third Reich, and then did nothing at all. Plans to send her as a spy to Syria, Australia, and Dakar all came to nothing. Kliman was far more interested in exploring the pleasures of Paris and discussing his love life. He remained besotted with Yvonne Delidaise, a nice girl, but without much principle, in Lily's opinion. Yvonne had long fair hair, blue eyes, and a turned-up nose, and dressed in frills, which Kliman liked to buy her. In her diary, Lily described Yvonne as pretty, but rather fat in build and with very broad hips. She was, however, 26 years old, and Kliman, nearing 50, was infatuated. He played her the violin until he wept. One night he told Lily that he had decided to divorce his wife and marry Yvonne, but had not yet gotten around to telling his wife or Yvonne. Kliman paid Lily a retainer of 3,000 francs a month. She was taught Morse code by Richard Delidaise, Yvonne's brother, a barman at Le Bourget Airport, and a keen Nazi collaborator who had qualified as a wireless instructor before the war. Once she had mastered the rudiments of Morse, he revealed to her the mysteries of coding. Next, in an apartment near the Opera, she was introduced to two bald men who looked a little like birds of prey. They taught her how to make secret ink by melting a special, unidentified substance, dipping a toothpick in it, and then writing on ordinary writing paper that has been rubbed all over with dry cotton wool in order to raise the fibers very slightly. Lily, however, felt no closer to being sent on a spying mission than she had been when she first met Kliman, and her patience was fraying fast. Unpredictable and ambitious, she had complicated motives. She would later claim she had been driven by the purest patriotism, and always intended to switch sides as soon as possible. But she was also motivated by adventure, and the belief that she was destined to play the leading lady in her own drama. She had become fond of genial, romantic, inefficient Kliman, but found him infuriating. Lily was not a patient woman. To make matters worse, she was suffering from painful kidney stones. "This has been dragging on so long. The war will be over before I have had time to do anything," she complained to her diary. Finally, after Kliman failed to turn up for yet another meeting, Lily Sergeyev threw an almighty tantrum. Yvonne Delidaise found herself on the receiving end. "I am sick of it," Lily ranted. "I don't like to be made a fool of. It is always the same. He is not there, or he's just left, or he's in a conference. Nothing has been done for over a year, so let's call it a day." Then she slammed down the telephone. When Kliman turned up the next day and tried to pacify her, she tore a strip off him. "You shall not continue to treat me as if I was an old boot. I am not going to listen to you. I'm fed up, and you can look for someone else." Perhaps it was this histrionic performance that jolted Kliman into action. More likely, the major realized that unless he actually demonstrated some sort of activity to his bosses, his Lotus life in Paris might be in jeopardy. But whatever the reason, the sluggish German espionage machine cranked into life. Kliman arranged for them to rendezvous, and then, to Lily's astonishment, kept to the arrangement. "It is the first time the Major has ever arrived on time for an appointment," she wrote. He was suddenly a paragon of crisp efficiency. He had orders from Berlin. Lily was to make her way to Britain via Madrid, posing as a refugee keen to serve the Allied cause by any means in your power. She would use the codename Solange, while Kliman would sign his message Octave. She would be met in Madrid by one of the local Abwehr agents. "He could recognize you by your little dog, as you insist on taking Babs with you." Kliman would join her in Madrid in a few weeks' time and bring her a wireless transmitter hidden inside a gramophone player. He ended with a pompous exhortation. "I have confidence in your success. You must not doubt. You must succeed." As the train pulled out from Gare d'Austerlitz, Lily, Agent Solange, wrote in her diary, "I wave a handkerchief at Mummy standing on the platform. Babs sniffs with satisfaction. I pull up the window, make a place for Babs. I'm leaving France to try to help those who want to set her free." 5. The Club. In the MI5 offices on St. James's Street, John Masterman was thinking, as usual, about spies and cricket. The double-cross team was shaping up into a decent squad, he reflected, with new contenders appearing all the time. Some of the new arrivals were naturals, eager to play, and signed up almost immediately. Others were untalented or uncooperative and were dealt with accordingly. Josef Jacobs, a 43-year-old German dentist, was found in a Cambridgeshire field in early February with a broken ankle. Unable to move, he had fired his revolver to attract attention. After Jacobs's interrogation at Camp 020, Tinai Stevens briskly concluded that Jacobs was a scrofulous Nazi and manifestly unemployable as a double agent, since he showed no inclination to collaborate. He was tried and sentenced to death by firing squad. "He died at the Tower of London," wrote Tinai, "a brave man. His last words directed the firing squad to shoot straight." Much more promising were two young Norwegians, John Moo and Tor Glatt, who had been dropped off the Scottish coast by a German seaplane and then rowed to the rocky shoreline of Banffshire in a rubber dinghy, loaded down with sabotage equipment, a wireless, and two bicycles. They immediately turned themselves in to the astonished Scottish police. Their story was corroborated by Bletchley's most secret sources, and they were duly enrolled into the double-cross system with the codenames Mutt and Jeff, after the popular American comic strip about two mismatched and somewhat dim-witted gamblers. The names were unfair, as Mutt and Jeff would develop into unflashy but solid middle-order all-rounders. Danish fascist Wolf Schmidt, alias Agent Tate, was also proving a useful player. Though he was not allowed to operate his own transmitter, owing to lingering doubts that his newfound loyalty to this country would survive any real strain. But the chicken feed Tate was sending to Germany appeared to be going down well, and in time he would become, in Masterman's words, a pearl among agents, setting the record for the longest continuous radio contact with Germany. By far the most talented of the early recruits was Dushko Popov, Agent Scoot, the libidinous Serb playboy, who was proving not only good at the game, but slightly too good to be true. First one side, and then the other, trusted him, and then began to wonder whether it should. The first to raise serious doubts was William Billy Luke, the MI5 case officer assigned to handle him. An industrialist from Glasgow, who owned a linen thread company, Luke was not unlike Popov in character, with a roving eye and a taste for the high life, which was exactly why Tower Robertson had chosen him for the job. He could match Popov drink for drink, and almost girl for girl. But Billy Luke was worried. "I cannot help regarding him with a good deal of suspicion. I just have the general feeling that he may be a most accomplished liar. Had Popov lied to MI5? Might he be a plant?" After a month in Lisbon, Popov flew back to London, where he was subjected to a second interrogation even more penetrating than the first. Popov told Robertson and Luke that he had been warmly welcomed at Lisbon's Portela Airport by von Karstorff himself. Back at the Villa Toki Anna, he had recited his rehearsed story in detail, describing the meeting with Ewan Montague and the snippets of information he had supposedly gleaned. Von Karstorff had then flown to Paris to report to his Abwehr superiors, and returned with the verdict that, although they were not very impressed and thought the answers too general, they felt Popov would make an excellent agent. There was no hint of suspicion. Indeed, they seemed to have blind confidence in Agent Ivan and wanted him dispatched back to England to gather more intelligence as soon as possible. Von Karstorff had issued Popov fresh secret ink and a lengthy new questionnaire covering a vast array of subjects, including morale, military matters, and politics. "You'll soon want to know what Churchill had for dinner," Popov remarked. "The Abwehr expected much from his second visit," von Karstorff observed. Great rewards would be his if Popov worked hard and improved the quality of his information. Von Karstorff hinted at a possible mission to the United States. Popov had happily spent the remaining weeks in Lisbon, wining and dining at von Karstorff's expense, establishing business contacts, and conducting an affair with a divorced French marquise. Popov was certain the trip to Lisbon had been a resounding success. The amusements laid on for Popov the previous Christmas had given him a taste of London's wartime high life, and he was a little disappointed to find he was now expected to make his own entertainment. "London is rather a dull place," he wrote to Johnny Yebsen in secret ink. "Most of the nice girls have gone to the country, and whiskey is 16 shillings a bottle. That would make you very unhappy. Popov did not demand to be paid. The Germans were already rewarding him handsomely. But as MI5 would soon discover, he did expect to be provided with what he considered the necessities of life, namely wine, women, and song, especially women. Tar Robertson was a man of the world, but even he was mildly taken aback when Popov hinted that a little high-class feminine society would be most acceptable. Robertson had never been asked to act as a procurer before, but he knew where to find an expert. Sergeant Lewis of the Metropolitan Police Vice Squad was asked for suggestions as to possible female acquaintances who might be used as agents. MI5 was not looking for a prostitute, Tar insisted, but a woman purely and simply to entertain Scoot and keep him out of mischief, at the same time to keep us informed of the various curious associations which he is making in this country. Lewis said he had a candidate in mind. Popov's MI5 file contains a number of amorous notes sent to Popov from Gwenny, who was married to Charles and worked, during daylight hours, for the Red Cross. A typical example reads, "I won't be able to see you tomorrow after all, as Charles is unexpectedly coming to London. He won't be here for long, so I'll ring you as soon as I can. I'm so sorry, as I was ready for you. Love, Gwenny." She was almost certainly an MI5 plant. Popov almost certainly knew it, and he certainly did not mind. Gwenny's full name has been carefully expunged from the record. She remains one more unsung heroine, performing sterling, though unconventional wartime service for her country. Von Karstoff's new questionnaire indicated significant German interest in Scotland's coastal defences, and so it was decided that Billy Luke would take Popov on a tour of his homeland. That way, Popov could accurately describe to von Karstoff what he had seen, while being steered away from things he should not see. It would also be an opportunity for Luke to test Popov's honesty and show him a good time. Just how good a time Popov was having could be measured by the colour of his face. "Complexion depends on previous night's activity," Tar Robertson noted dryly. "If the night has been a good one, from his point of view, the complexion is rather white and blotchy." Popov and Luke's tour of the north turned into an extended pub crawl, the day spent among typical Scottish scenery, and the nights filled with jovial entertainment in congenial company. They visited Loch Lomond and Garloch, stopping for regular refreshments, and then headed to Edinburgh. Popov later recalled, "There was a law that existed at that time that you couldn't have a drink unless you had travelled 5 miles, and so my case officer, being a true Scotsman, interpreted this as meaning that you had to stop and have a drink every 5 miles. In Edinburgh, they stayed at the Central Hotel, drank at the American Bar and the Piccadilly Club, and dined at the Malmaison and the Mirabelle. Popov was plainly not spying for Germany, Luke reported, since he made no effort to obtain information of any kind, nor did he ask any questions which could be connected with espionage. But in the course of their evening pleasures, Popov did drop one particularly interesting hint about his friend Johnny Yebsen. He did not think it would be difficult to persuade Yebsen that he is fighting on the wrong side. Yebsen is at heart pro-British. Popov even suggested he might be able to recruit for MI5 the man who had recruited him to German intelligence, especially if he could meet him in Madrid, provide him with vivacious and beautiful feminine society, and lose money to him at poker. Here was a tempting prize, a member of the Abwehr who might be lured into the double-cross pack. "It may be desirable to enlarge on this theme," wrote Luke. After 3 days of carousing and sightseeing, Luke returned to London, white and blotchy, impressed by Popov's stamina, and fully reassured that he was not, after all, playing a triple game. "He is quite definitely working for us and not the Germans," wrote Luke. "Clever, versatile and firm of purpose, he has personality and charm, and would feel at home in society circles in any European or American capital, being much the usual type of international playboy. He misses no opportunity of disparaging the Germans and the Nazi leaders, and has a great hatred of Goebbels, a wholehearted admiration and respect for the English, and is convinced that Great Britain will win the war. His prodigious womanizing might eventually be a problem," Luke predicted. "He is fond of the society of attractive women, who are apparently plentiful in Dubrovnik, where it seems that virtue is at a discount. His amorous exploits would provide material for Maurice de Cobre, the French erotic novelist. But Luke was now certain that Popoff was dependable and ready to risk his life again by returning to Lisbon. Scoot is an ingenious, cheerful, and amusing companion, of whose sincerity and loyalty I personally am satisfied. Unknown to Popoff, his older brother Ivo, a doctor in Belgrade, had also approached MI6 with an offer to spy against the Germans. The Popoff family was firmly on side. Reassured, Tar set about building up Popoff with some first-class chicken feed, verifiable but harmless answers to his questionnaire that would convince his Abwehr handler that he was, indeed, the efficient and energetic spy he seemed to be. Von Karsthoff had suggested that Popoff should recruit some sub-agents, should he find anyone suitable. MI5 obliged. The first was Dickie Metcalf, a former army intelligence officer. To von Karsthoff, Metcalf would be portrayed as a disgruntled, broken-down gambler working for an arms dealer, who had been cashiered for passing fake checks and was prepared to spy on his former colleagues because he hates them all. Since Metcalf was portly, he was given the codename Balloon. A second sub-agent was lined up in the more svelte form of Friedel Gärtner, a 34-year-old Austrian cabaret singer, well-connected in London society, who had already done work for MI5. Her father had been a member of the Nazi Party, so it was hoped that when the Germans came to check up on her, she would be considered reliable. Gärtner was a link with people of a high state of society in this country, and therefore in a position to get good information from indiscretions of well-placed friends in government and diplomatic circles. She was given the codename Gelatin, because the word almost rhymes with Jolly Little Thing, which is how the men of B1A saw her. Popoff also saw her that way. Inevitably, they became lovers. Now that he was no longer considered likely to scoot, Popoff was also awarded a new codename, more fitting to his status as the most promising of double agents. He was rechristened Tricycle. This may have been, in part, a reference to Popoff's insatiable appetites and his reputed, but probably apocryphal, taste for three-in-a-bed sex. It also recognized that the Tricycle network now consisted of one big wheel, Popoff, supported by two smaller ones, Agents Balloon and Gelatin. While Robertson was playing word games with his agents Nom de Guerre, Popoff had some fun with Tar's nickname. He had asked MI5 for help in setting up his own import-export business, which would provide good cover as well as a genuine income. They proposed to buy and sell anything in any market, wrote Tar, who arranged for Popoff to occupy a lair of offices in Imperial House, 80 Regent Street. MI5 even produced an attractive part-time secretary to handle Popoff's correspondence and mind the business. In a tip of the hat to his spymaster, Popoff named the new company Tar Lair Limited. As he prepared to head back to Portugal once again, Popoff was a little anxious that the answers we had given him to his questionnaire were lacking in detail and would jeopardize his supposed position as a good spy. He was also suffering slight moral scruples about the part he was playing, simultaneously befriending and betraying von Karsthoff. Masterman offered a typically donnish and convoluted reassurance. The strictest moral censor, having regard to his motives, would not cavil his conduct. Popoff, whose English was not quite Oxbridge standard, surely had not a clue what he was saying. Luke spoke a simpler language, telling him that the work he had undertaken was extremely valuable to this country. That conversation seemed to reassure Popoff, for he penned a farewell letter to his case officer that revealed an unexpected depth of purpose in this apparently pleasure-seeking young man. It would be difficult for me to define the feeling I experience on leaving your brave country. I am leaving with a heart filled with hope. You, my dear Luke, are the classical example of English calm, a manifestation of the most powerful English weapon, to remain human. It is this that will demolish Hitler's machine. On the day of Popov's departure, Luke took him to lunch at the Savoy and found him cheery but somewhat tired, pale and blotchy. He had spent what he called an expensive evening the night before, after an exhausting week featuring Friedel, Gwenny, the 400 Club, Coconut Grove, and dinners at the Hungaria. Popov requested a small automatic revolver in case of need, and seemed entirely unfazed when Luke explained that this might be tricky and possibly unwise. Popov was stepping back into extreme danger, and they both knew it. We could do nothing to help him if things went wrong. Agent Tricycle sauntered off with a slightly rolling gait, the very reverse of military, to catch the Lisbon plane, leaving MI5 to pay his stupendous hotel bill. Luke and Popov were birds of a feather, and Tar observed the bond growing between them with satisfaction. In the shifting, shadowy world of Double Cross, the relationship between agent and handler was fundamental. A case officer should be personally responsible for each agent, with his hands, as it were, on the pulse of the patient from morning until night, and with an eye on every twist and turn of the patient's mind. David Petrie, the chief of MI5, had ordered that B-section should command the best talent and experience that the service possesses, but it was not easy to find people equipped to act as friend, psychologist, and patient nursemaid to a group of individuals who were, almost by definition, erratic, frequently infuriating, and quite possibly disloyal. Section B1A was expanding, and what had started as an experiment was fast becoming a major enterprise. The running and control of double agents, wrote Masterman, is a very long, laborious, and infinitely complicated task, a truly formidable work of coordination, preparation, and crucial analysis. Each double agent required the whole time service of a case officer to control and organize him, a wireless officer to monitor and perhaps submit his messages, at least two guards, possibly an officer with a car to collect his information, and probably a housekeeper to look after and feed the whole party. The MI5 offices on St. James's Street were becoming distinctly crowded. Tar Robertson sat in the first office, while the adjoining room was shared by Masterman and John Marriott, Tar's chief assistant and deputy. A solicitor in civilian life, Marriott was the collector of facts, a stickler for rules and economies, the dry, nitpicking counterpoint to Tar's extravagance and ebullience, who peered at the world suspiciously through bottle-topped spectacles. The case officers, already five in number, sat together in the largest office, along with two filing clerks and another officer responsible for disseminating intelligence arising from the cases. The officers, each hand-picked by Robertson, were a distinctly unorthodox crew. In addition to Billy Luke, their number included Cyril Mills, a part-time circus impresario, Hugh Astor, the son of Times owner Lord Astor, and two very different lawyers, Ian Wilson, methodical and withdrawn, and Christopher Harmer, witty, intuitive, and glintingly clever. As shown by the effort that went into choosing code names, the agent runners delighted in wordplay, and the atmosphere at Number 58 was relaxed and frequently hilarious. They were an extraordinarily youthful team. Tar was just 30 when war began, and Hugh Astor was just 23 when he joined the team. Harmer, a year younger than Tar, described B1A as a group of overgrown schoolboys playing games of daring do, absorbed from reading schoolboy books and adventure stories. There was also one schoolgirl, although it would have taken a brave man to describe her as such. Gisella Ashley, who went by the spy name of Susan Barton, was at this time the only woman in the section, and a most formidable intelligence operative. German-born and vigorously anti-Nazi, Gisella had left Germany in the 1920s, appalled by the rise of German fascism. She married a British man and then divorced him when he turned out to be homosexual, retained her British citizenship, joined MI5, and established a lifelong partnership with another intelligence officer, Gilbert Lennox, with whom she wrote a number of successful stage plays. Mrs. Barton had been a casual agent for some years before the war, reporting on the German community in Britain. Her play, Third Party Risk, opened at St. Martin's Theatre in 1939, shortly after she moved to The Hague, under diplomatic cover, to spy on the Germans. There, the secretary of the German naval attaché took a shine to her, and Gisella appeared to be on the point of penetrating the German legation when disaster struck. In November 1939, two MI6 agents were lured to a rendezvous at Venlo, on the Dutch border, in the belief that they were meeting an anti-Nazi officer and kidnapped. One of them, astonishingly, was carrying in his pocket a list of British agents, including, it was feared, Gisela Ashley. She was hurriedly recalled and assigned to Robertson's section. Gisela's brother was by now a U-boat captain, but Mrs. Barton's loyalty was never in doubt. With her real understanding of German and Nazi mentality, she played a vital role in B1A, and as the lone woman in a unit composed of men, she offered an important corrective to some of the more extreme chauvinism around her. Masterman barely noticed women. Marriott found the opposite sex tiresome and unpredictable. Wilson refused to allow women solicitors in his law firm, but they could not ignore Gisela Ashley. The vivacious Mrs. Barton, the secretary who opened his mail and ran the Tar Lair office, was Gisela Ashley, special agent, carefully placed at Popoff's elbow to keep an eye on him.